Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today is the last day of our fall membership drive, and public media, especially Prairie Public, needs your support now more than ever. If you value trusted news, educational programming, and local voices, please make your gift at prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145. Every contribution matters. First up today on Main Street, we'll hear from Tim Wetch, who shares what it's like to live with primary progressive aphasia, a rare form of dementia that begins with language, not memory. And we'll also hear practical resources from Joan Danks of the Alzheimer's Association of North Dakota. And in the second half of today's show, we visit with PBS President and CEO Paula Kerger about the future of public media, funding cuts, political pressure, and the digital shift, and why local stations in rural communities like ours remain essential. We begin Main Street today with Tim Wetch. He has a disease called primary progressive aphasia, or PPA. It's a rare type of dementia that shows up not as memory loss, but as language problems. Tim, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
What is PPA?
PPA is short for primary progressive aphasia, which is a very rare form of dementia. It mainly encompasses the language, understanding, comprehension, reading, writing, part of the brain.
As I understand it, it's a type of dementia.
Yes, it's a very rare type of dementia. It's so rare, I believe there's probably around 50,000 people in the United States that diagnosed with it. So it's so rare that people don't understand it. Physicians don't even understand it. Once I was diagnosed with it, I've been in touch with Northwestern University down in Chicago. We were dealing with them they want to do studies. The doctor that first diagnosed this disease, he'd been doing study for about 20 years now. It took us about 6-7 months to get accepted. And they accepted me in to the study. And they brought us down last November. It's what they do, they'll bring me down there every 2 years to study me. You know, they'll do the testing, all the scans and stuff. And I know it's not going to help me, but if I can help somebody else, try to figure out, get some kind of roadmap of this disease. There's no roadmap. Every person that they have is different.
When did you first notice changes, Tim, in your language abilities?
It's been going on for a number of years. My wife and I, we've been having difficulty communicating.
Is this something that she recognized first, maybe even before you did?
Well, she recognized something was going on, but you don't even think about this type of a disease. And finally, because we were having the same conversation over and over and over, and finally I just said, you're talking a foreign language to me. I have no clue what you're talking about. And that clicked some, buttons off, and the light started flashing a little bit, and it's like, okay, there's something going on here. We got in touch with, physicians, and they noticed that there's some glitches going on here.
How old were you at the time?
I've been diagnosed about 18 months ago.
And prior to that, no problems?
I've been, now looking back at it, I've been having issues for a few years prior, but I just hit it. Just breezed over the issues.
Tried to live. You tried to go on with your life.
Yes. You just keep moving forward, basically. And it got to the point where now it it's hurting me more trying to cover it up than helping me.
So you learned this was a type of dementia. How did you feel when you had that diagnosis, Tim?
It didn't hit me right away. It's like, oh, I just kind of, okay, this is what it is. Okay, no big deal. I'm still myself. I'm still doing what I do. I was working and everything at that time.
What was your vocation?
Pardon me?
You were working. What were you doing?
I worked in sales. I've been working in sales for almost 40 years. So communications was a very big thing in my profession. I mean, I dealt with customers all over the country here.
When I think, Tim, when people are listening to you, they might be thinking, well, wait, he sounds wonderful. He sounds really good. He's able to answer my questions. What is it that you would love for people to understand about what you're going through with PPA right now?
Well, you know, the first thing they hear that word dementia. And the first thing they think about dementia, Alzheimer's, you can't think, you don't know people, you don't know things, you become a zombie basically. And yes, that's part of dementia, part of the Alzheimer's, but it's not, there's so many different forms of types of different dementias. You know, basically think of dementia as the umbrella. And then you have all these other diagnoses underneath it, you know, frontal lobe dementia, PPA, which is mine, Alzheimer's. They all hang from that umbrella. And there's multitudes of more types. You know, in the past, the physicians, they didn't know all these different types and all these different kinds of dementias that's underneath that umbrella. So nobody really got tested. You know, years ago, you get labeled as you got dementia. That's just a blanket, you know, discussion. It's what kind of dementia. And there's all kinds of different treatments for the different types of, you know, diseases underneath that dementia.
Do you have treatments that you are undertaking, Tim?
I do some treatments. My treatment is, you know, meet with a therapist, speech therapy. They are training me on it's called an ACC device. It's basically like a iPhone. And it got programs in it, so when I'm not able to speak at some point, I could use that machine to speak for me.
Is that part of your future, do you think?
I'm hoping not, but reality, that's what everybody says. It's going to happen eventually. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to have Alzheimer's. It gives me a larger percentage of getting dementia or getting Alzheimer's. So they are, you know, they work with me all the time, try to come up with new techniques, you know, different ways of communicating. My main issue right now is it not so much the speaking part, which becomes issues when I get tired. I shut down. If there's lots of different conversations going on within a house or, you know, wherever you are, there's all kinds of different conversations going. I can't follow it. I can't follow anything because it's too much coming in from two different areas. And I just shut down. I just quit talking.
Tim, if I could, I want to reintroduce you to our listeners. I'm visiting with Tim Wetch. We're here in Bismarck, and Tim has been diagnosed with primary progressive aphasia, otherwise called PPA. It's a rare form of dementia that first shows up not as memory loss, but as language problems. Tell us more how your day-to-day life is changing, Tim.
Every day is a new day for me. No day is the same. I have retired from work here recently. It got to the point where it was just overwhelming. I can only do one thing at a time. So if somebody comes to me and asks, you know, do this and this and this, I want to get the first thing okay, what were the other ones? I don't, you know, it doesn't comprehend.
You seem very hopeful, though, to me, Tim. Am I correct in that?
You know, this is so much out of my comfort zone to be communicating my issues with the public, but I feel it's something that I want to give back as much as I can while I still can.
What is it that you want other people to know about people like you who have been diagnosed with a form of dementia? What is it that you really want them to understand?
It's not taboo. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's no different than cancer. You know, years ago, cancer was a taboo name. You know, nobody said cancer because it was just taboo. You stayed away from it. Now that cancer is being able to be, you know, diagnosed better, treatments, stuff like that, eventually they will have some kind of treatments for dementia, Alzheimer's, PPA, you know, so on and so. But it's going to take people to be willing to step up and help with diagnosis, try to get that roadmap basically in it so that people can understand. You know, we got thrown this PPA at us, and it's like we keep asking the question, what do we expect? What's going to happen? Even the professionals down at Northwestern University, they don't have a roadmap. And they've been studying this for years. It's not a, you know, try to help yourself will help others, basically.
Are there drug therapies that have been presented to you, Tim? And please don't answer if you feel that's too personal.
There has been no drugs that been basically approved for this diagnosis. There have been some brain stimulations going on.
What's that?
They put this, I think it's like a cap they put over you, and it's like electrodes and stuff, and then they stimulate different areas of the brain.
Have you had that therapy yet?
I have not. They told us about that when we were down in Chicago, down in November, but we would have to be in Chicago to be able to participate in that particular, you know, thing, because it's you do like 3 or 4 times each week. And with us living here in North Dakota, that just wouldn't work.
If you were to tell me one or two things you want people to take away from our conversation this morning about you and your challenges with PPA, what is it that you would like our listeners to really think about?
I guess I believe there's more people out there that has PPA that not being diagnosed. You know, if there's an issue out there, if there's some communication issues, at least, you know, talk to your doctor about it and stuff. And hopefully they can understand a little bit about it and get the right diagnosis. Because if they could catch it early, they do have some tools to help you.
To make life less frustrating, maybe?
Not so much less frustrating, but help you cope with what's going on. I was diagnosed, you know, at such a early stage, so that all the different treatment that they think might help is actually does help me somewhat. I don't really know for sure, but I feel it's helping me. Talking about this helps me, you know, a lot.
At this point, I would like to bring in Joan Danks. She's with the Alzheimer's Association of North Dakota. And Joan, thank you so much for telling us about Tim and allowing us to share his story. What is your relationship with someone like Tim who doesn't have Alzheimer's, yet you've made the connection and you are helpful?
Yeah. So first of all, thank you for having us. And Tim, thank you for sharing your story. It's so important, and I think it's just really wonderful to have people like Tim that are willing to share their story because that makes a big difference. So my work at the Alzheimer's Association, we offer support and services to people that are living with Alzheimer's and all forms of dementia. And so what we do is when people contact us and they say, hey, we want to talk, we help them find resources that would be helpful. And so when Tim connected with us and with me, he came in and he said, you know, I want to share my story. I want to make a difference. And so that's how we came here. That's when I found you and we made the connection. And so whenever people come to us, it could be, you know, for a variety of reasons. It might be because they're having communication issues. Maybe there's some behavior issues, of course, memory and thinking and all of those things. And so my team and I and at the Alzheimer's Association, that's what we do. We help people get connected and educate them and really just try to support them in the journey.
In Tim's case, now you've made some connections. What about your future relationship with him?
Yeah, well, we're here, right? We've made that connection. We are getting to know each other, and we're here to support in the journey. So as things progress and any type of support that they need, we're here for them.
There are people who are listening who might now be thinking, maybe I should make a phone call.
Yeah. Yeah, so definitely you can call us regardless of a diagnosis. If you have concerns with memory, thinking, language issues, and you're concerned that it could be some form of dementia, give us a call. We do have a 1-800 number that you can call, and so I'll share
that. What is the number?
If anyone is looking for support in North Dakota or across the country, they can call our 1-800 number, which is 1-800-272-3900.
Tim, you're back with us now in our conversation, and it's just been a wonderful conversation. Your wife is with us in the studio.
She is.
How important has her support been to you, Tim?
She's my anchor. If I didn't have her, I'd be lost. She keeps me, you know, focused as much as I can, keeps me motivated. If I get very frustrated sometimes, she's there to try to calm me down. When we're in crowds, I'm hanging on to her because she's the one who gets me through it. And large crowds, lots of noisy stuff, you know, especially like concerts and stuff like that. When you have chaos, when it's over with and everybody gets up all at one time and stuff, I'm sitting in my chair holding on, don't know what to do. She's there to comfort me and get me through it. So without her, I'd be totally lost.
Tim, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Just don't be afraid to at least look into, you know, the different types of dementias and stuff that's out there. You know, don't be afraid to get tested. You know, it's hard. Yes, it is. I'm not going to say it's easy, but it's helpful at least. The family will know what to kind of expect and moving forward. They know, you know, everybody can help everybody work through it. I mean, it's not, once you're diagnosed with it, you're thrown out the door. You know, the family, it helps the family know what's going on.
Best wishes to you, Tim.
Thank you.
My guest has been Tim Wetsch. He has primary progressive aphasia. And through our connections with the North Dakota Alzheimer's Association and Joan Danks, we've made the connection with you, Tim. I just wish you the best, and thank you for your willingness to share your story with our listeners.
No problem. Thank you much for everybody.
I'm Craig Blumenschein, and you are listening to Main Street here on Prairie Public. It was such an honor for me to visit with someone like Tim, and I'm really blessed that I get a visit with North Dakotans each and every day and to hear their stories, and that's what makes Prairie Public so powerful. And Prairie Public is powered by listeners, and this afternoon we hope to hear from you during our annual fall membership drive. We've heard from folks in Minot, in Jamestown, Wahpeton, and Grand Forks through this drive, and now we hope to hear from you. You can make your donation at prairiepublic.org
or you can call us at 800-359-4145. I am pleased to be joined by Christine McClellan. She's a communications manager here at Prairie Public. Christine, we count on Main Street to tell the stories, but you also get to tell our story through the television side, through the radio side, and you also tell stories that aren't so easy, like this time of year and this time for us when it's tough.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely, since I've been here for almost 10 years, been a first for us when it comes to having to communicate the funding cuts that we've been going through, the federal funding cuts, and ultimately I'm sure people have heard about the staff cuts and the positions that we had to cut just last week or a couple weeks ago now. And yeah, it's really hard, but it all comes down to communicating our mission and why we do what we do, and that we're committed to not going away. You know, we're not giving up. We know that we still have the support of our listeners across the state and in Northwest Minnesota and viewers up in Manitoba and who believe in our mission and want to help us get through this. So we know that we can count on them and that they want to see us succeed.
Your communications are so important, and they'll continue. I'm sure that after today, Christine, we'll be asking folks to support Prairie Public. But now is a great time, and it's an important time. Prairie Public is, as Christine said now, we're member-supported. We have things that are serious to talk about, and we need to hear from you. We're asking you to make a donation at prairiepublic.org or give us a call at 800-359-4145. Behind every headline is a person. In our news department, it's a journalist, it's a reporter. For me, it's a producer and host of this show we have called Main Street, and it's people that make North Dakota home. We are here in North Dakota, and Christine, it's our honor to tell North Dakota stories, and that's something that you get to do in your communications.
Yeah. And, you know, we are here today to ask for member support. It's the last day of our fall radio membership drive. And this year we set a goal for this drive for $70,000. This is something that it's actually the highest goal
it would
that we've
be a
ever
record.
Had. It would be a record. Yeah. The last time in a radio drive that we raised $68,000 in 2001. So we're trying to beat that.
And we are close.
We're very close. We only have about $11,000 left. I know that we can make it to our goal, but of course that it just depends on your support right now to determine how we finish. So let's finish this drive together. Make your gift now at prairiepublic.org, or you can give us a call, 800-359-4145.
What I hope is that if you ever feel Main Street has helped you feel more connected to your friends, to your neighbors, to your friends who are here in North Dakota, it's the power of local public media. And public media is what needs public support, and that's why we're here today. As Christine said, go online. It takes just a few seconds. prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on Main Street, PBS President and CEO Paula Gerger on funding cuts, political pressure, and the shift to digital, plus her thoughts about AI and how PBS is bolstering small market stations and why trust remains the North Star. That's after this news.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and public media is at a crossroads. This summer, Congress pulled back more than $1 billion in federal support for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, leaving many local and rural stations facing an uncertain future. And at the same time, trust in public media remains higher than most other outlets, even as PBS and NPR continue to face political scrutiny. Leading PBS through this moment is Paula Gerger, its longtime president and CEO. She's guided the system through political pressure, funding challenges, and a shift to digital platforms, all while holding on to PBS's mission to educate, inform, and inspire. Today, she joins us on Main Street to talk about the future of public media, the role of local stations, and what it all means, especially for rural communities like ours. Paula, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
We are pleased that you are with us today. What message are you bringing to our listeners? to the folks here in Fargo, to the folks in rural North Dakota?
Yeah, well, this is obviously a profoundly important moment for public media. If you look back in our history, I think this will be remembered as one of those key moments. And I think the important thing, probably the most important message of all, is we are here and we will stay. And we will do that because the community will support us. You know, we oftentimes say on public television, thanks to viewers like you. And that has been a critically important part of this public-private partnership that PBS represents. And in this moment, we do need everyone that relies on public broadcasting to step up and say, this is important. I'm investing in this for my family, for my community. And if we are able to be successful in persuading people to step up in this moment, I think we will manage through this very difficult
time. What I've often thought about, Paula, is that, okay, if I have a million or two or three in my demographic, that's kind of easier. Mm-hmm. But here we are in rural America.
Yeah.
It's more difficult.
Does that worry you? It does worry me. And in fact, when we were defunded in July, one of the very first things that I did was focus with a small group of foundations that is putting together resources, particularly for rural communities. I've been in this job almost 20 years. And when I took the job, I started traveling around the country because I wanted to see firsthand what our public television stations were doing in the communities that they serve. In fact, Fargo was very early on my whistle stop. I knew John Harris. I knew the great work and the legacy of the station, and I wanted to see it myself. And that is why when the funding went away, my first priority was to make sure that stations have the opportunity to think about how they're going to build their capacity moving forward. I haven't given up, by the way, on federal funding coming back. I do think that as legislators evaluate the future moving forward, they're particularly focused on the impact to rural and stations that serve smaller communities. And so I think if we come together in this moment, we try to keep the funding strong so that the station stays strong, and we make the case to legislators why this matters, I think we will be successful.
So you hope that federal funding may come back someday. But in the interim, what concerns you most? Is it news? Is it children's services and programming, emergency alerts, our ability to reach maybe non-traditional populations?
All of those things worry me, of course. And I think that, you know, for so many communities, not the case here. You have other local news in this community that is run by local media organizations, but in most parts of the country, that's not the case.
And that's not the case necessarily in rural or western North Dakota.
Actually, that's true. And so I do think that it is important, you know, as we get ready to mark the 250th anniversary of our country's founding. Part of the tenets of this democracy only works if you have an informed citizenry. And so it really is important for people to have places where they can get information that they trust, and particularly at the local level, which is where I see clear market failure. When you look back on how public media evolved in this country, remember, we're a little different than our cousins from across the pond, say, at the BBC and others. Public media came first, commercial media came second. In this country, commercial media came first. But it was recognized pretty early on that the commercial marketplace was not going to fill all of the needs of communities. That was true when there were four channels, and it is definitely true now. If you've ever been just subsumed by the mass of content that is coming at you from multiple places, some of it now generated by AI, not always clear who has created the content and what's the source and how trusted it is. This is a role of a public media station. We're not interested in selling widgets or selling to consumers. What we're interested in is really building community across the country and giving people the information they need to make good decisions for their families and for the communities in which they live.
Well, I need to ask you, and you've heard this before, the criticism that folks argue that public media has become more liberal over time or has a liberal bias and therefore shouldn't receive any taxpayer money. What is your message to people in this red state who have heard that?
We historically have received a lot of support, both in the support of legislators as well as contributors, individuals and foundations, some that are very conservative and that believe in the kind of values that we instill in the programming we do. Look at our children's programming, for example. Our children's programming is really based on a very simple idea that every child should have the right to achieve their potential. And so the programs that we create are about basic math and literacy skills that a child will need when they first enter school, but also character skills. You know, and I think all of that very much is appealing to people that are perhaps more conservative. We create a lot of content for classrooms. A significant number of people that use our material are homeschoolers. And so I think that we are at a moment in our country where I think particularly with media, people are looking to go to media spaces where they see their opinions reflected back. We're in a different business. Our goal is to bring people news and information and let you make your own decisions. And I think for some, perhaps they see that as perhaps a bit more liberal, but we are constantly looking to make sure that we are bringing a multiplicity of voices forward. Because I think in this moment in our country where we feel so separated and we struggle with the opportunities to come together, this is a role that public broadcasting can play. Remember, this is where Bill Buckley created his whole career. You know, this is not new to public broadcasting. This is a piece of what PBS has always done and will continue to do moving forward.
Joining my conversation with Paula Kerger, she's the president and CEO of PBS, and we're visiting in the Fargo studios of Prairie Public. Paula, it's very nice to have you here. The other criticism that we sometimes hear about public media is it's great about listening to the noise from the population centers of our country and not so great listening to those of us who live in the rural areas that you just talked about. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, I would say a few things. One is a lot of our content actually comes from all across the country, and I'm very excited that we're bringing back, for example, a second season of Southern Storytellers. We are getting a whole new series coming out of Texas. I'm really interested in hearing and understanding people from across the country. And the other thing is in public television, public radio, particularly public radio actually, we have journalists all across the country that live in communities. And to be able to take advantage of some of that reporting, it puts us in a very different place than any other media organization where the stories are really being told from people from away.
Let me ask you this question about trust. I referenced it in my open to our discussion today. It is true, I think, generally, that public media is trusted more than other media. However, it's also true maybe that that trust is not what it used to be. Do you see it that way?
Well, I see trust in many public institutions has declined over the last few years. I think people have become very skeptical. But I also know I sometimes wear clothing, T-shirts, and caps and so forth that have the PBS logo, and I cannot tell you the cross-section of people that come up to me and say, you are so important, we trust you. I mean, just think about our kids' programming, for example. We have a very significant audience of children's programming. Parents trust us with the part of their life that is the most precious, their children. And so we take that seriously. And when you look at how we're funded, obviously there was the government funded, but the biggest piece of money that comes to public broadcasting comes from individual contributions, lots of small contributions. People give to organizations they trust. And I think that part of what has kept us anchored in all the work we do is because we have the social contract with all of these people across the country who support us and have supported us generously, particularly now in the last few months.
As you look at that support, can it replace what has been lost from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for example? Are there new partnerships that you're exploring that we really should be excited about?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the philanthropy, and you know, you referenced $1 billion, that's over 2 years, so it's really $500 million. That's a significant amount of money. But it represents 15% of the money that actually comes into public broadcasting. So it is significant. And in a community like this that really has relied more heavily on the federal appropriation, it is even more significant. But I believe that not just philanthropy, but potentially also partnerships with other producing organizations and so forth. For many years, we've worked with other public broadcasters. And I think there are opportunities for us to bring new resources into public broadcasting and for us to survive and thrive in the future.
As we wrap up our conversation, Paula, when I visited your headquarters near Washington, D.C., I was struck by how many young people were working for you at the time, and this has been now about a decade ago. I'm concerned now, because of a lot of different pressures, that young people are not as interested in journalism. Does that concern you?
Everywhere I go, I talk to journalism professors, and I ask them about the kids that are coming into their classes. And there is this resurgence of really great interest in news and journalism and the importance of it. Part of it, I think, is fueled by the fact that kids now have many different options of where they can publish and push out information.
From their home, for example.
And a lot of them are online and they are already engaged. But I am really heartened by the number of young people that really want to pursue what you and I would think of as traditional journalism careers. They see the importance of it, and they want to be able to tell stories that matter, and they want to be able to tell stories that are going to reach a wide population, not just a small niche of friends and people that might be attracted to their podcast. So I think there's a lot of hope there.
Funding issues aside, is AI something that you really worry about? Does it keep you up at night?
It does. But it also, I think, has the potential of offering up some opportunities for us, particularly in education, where I think, because we've learned a lot about interactivity and how that really sparks education and learning. And in my spare time, I've been playing around with Duolingo over the last year. And I've seen firsthand how it has shaped based on the responses that I give. So I think that we need to be very concerned. I think particularly around editorial, that I worry that people are going to take shortcuts and use AI to create content. If you look at searches that you do online, you'll see a scraped summary, and you can read through it and very quickly pick out all the wrong information in it. I think we need to be better educated, and especially kids, but all of us, in how we evaluate the source of information, the veracity of it. But I think that there is an opportunity there that we also shouldn't ignore, but we've got to do it carefully, and we have to do it with a lot of transparency.
Well, best wishes to you.
Thank you.
And to the service you provide to PBS and to public media. My guest is Paula Kerger. She's the president and CEO of PBS, and she's joined us here in Fargo. We've heard that public media faces real challenges, from funding cuts to political pressure. And we hope that we've reminded you, that Paula has reminded you, of the value that public media brings, which is trusted news, educational programming, and local voices.
That's it. So make your contribution now.
We're still within our pledge drive time, so that's a...
Oh, great. My message then is perfect.
Your message is perfect.
It's important, and I think sometimes people hold back because they think that their contribution isn't going to matter. It matters a lot. Every contribution matters, so join.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was a great message from Paula, the chairman and CEO of PBS. I'm with Kristen McClellan. My name is Craig Blumenschein. Kristen is the communications manager here at Prairie Public, and I am the host and producer of Main Street. And we are hopeful now that you'll take Paula's cue there and our cue here in the next few minutes to become a supporting, sustaining member here at Prairie Public. Now is a wonderful time. You can give us a call at 800-359-4145. Or you can make your gift today. Prairie Public is powered by members. Right now, we need your help. Online is where you can make that gift at prairiepublic.org. Main Street, you're listening to us now, is where we get to meet the voices of North Dakota, ranchers, educators, artists, change makers. Tomorrow on Main Street, we have the 100th year story of football at Dickinson State University, Christine.
I love that. That sounds really interesting.
It's their 100th season. And
I can't even believe that.
Homecoming this week.
Oh, exciting. And those are the types of stories that I love to hear on Main Street. Just, I'm not a football fan, but I would love to hear about 100 years of football at Dickinson State. I just never would have guessed that it's been that long. And, just stories
Theodore
from our
Roosevelt
region. Oh, yeah,
had something to do with improving the safety of the game.
Okay.
Way back in the day. So lots tomorrow on Main Street. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah, that is so great. Thank you, Craig. And yeah, today is the final day of our fall radio fundraiser. Like I said earlier, we set a $70,000 goal for this membership drive. And that is a huge record for us for a radio membership drive. Previously, the record that we have raised during a radio membership drive is $68,000. And we're actually really close to our goal, and we just have the rest of today to make that. More than half of our members give as monthly sustainers. So that's people who make a small gift each month. And that adds up to huge impact, and that steady support really keeps Prairie Public strong through challenges like we've faced recently, like the federal funding cuts. So your donation today will help close that gap and power the programs like Main Street, music, and news that you count on every day. So let's finish this drive together. Make your gift now at prairiepublic.org or give us a call, 800-359-4145.
Here on the radio side of Prairie Public, Christine gets to work with both us on the radio side and our colleagues who work on the television service at Prairie Public. But we understand and we think about that public radio is built for our listeners. And more specifically, it's our listeners who are our neighbors here in North Dakota and Western Minnesota. We bring local news that hopefully gets you ready for the day and the conversations that open your mind, and the music, of course, that lifts your spirits. When you support Prairie Public, you're not just giving to a station, you're giving to yourself and to your community. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. You're supporting public radio, public television, our education services throughout our whole region. And as you know, this has been one of the hardest years Prairie Public's ever faced. We've had cuts at the state level, cuts at the federal level, and we really rely on our members to keep us going and helping us stay strong in the future. Today is our last day of our fall drive. We still need to raise about $11,000 to reach our goal, so please stand with us. Go to prairiepublic.org or give us a call, 800-359-4145.
And Christine, before we end this pledge break here, we want folks to know that their support does more than keep programs on the air. We feel we strengthen our community, we connect our neighbors, and we lift up local voices that you won't hear anywhere else in the public broadcasting system other than from us here at Prairie Public. Please, now, go to prairiepublic.org. Thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 6th. In the late 1800s, farm machinery evolved from simple tools to mechanized equipment. Horses began to disappear from the fields as tractors took their place. Mechanical twine binders and cream separators improved efficiency. New methods in irrigation and crop rotation improved yield and sustainability. The future seemed bright and exciting for the farmer. Unfortunately, there seemed to be a sticking point in the effort to modernize agriculture. Researchers discovered that adults in the farming community were reluctant to embrace new methods. North Dakota farmers were skeptical of the students from the North Dakota Agricultural College who tried to introduce modern advancements. Students often heard the same question, "What can these college boys teach us?" There was, however, a bright spot in the research. Young people were open to new thinking and anxious to try new methods. Adults began forming community clubs to introduce new methods to young people. This hands-on learning could inspire them to embrace new ideas. The youth program started in Clark County, Ohio in 1902 and is considered the birth of America's 4-H program. Later that same year, agricultural clubs sprang up in Minnesota. By 1924, 4-H clubs were formed into a national organization with a four-leaf clover as its symbol. Cooperative extension programs at land-grant universities embraced 4-H as a way to inspire young people. On this date in 2024, 4-H chapters across the country began celebrating National 4-H Week. Governor Doug Burgum's proclamation acknowledging the week notes the program, overseen by the North Dakota State University Cooperative Extension Program, supports future leaders in science, agriculture, and community leadership. The proclamation adds that youth who participate in 4-H achieve positive youth development outcomes based on opportunities for supervised independence, a sense of belonging with a positive group, a spirit of generosity toward others, and a wide variety of opportunities to master life's challenges. Originally based in agriculture, 4-H has grown to include a broad variety of topics, including animal sciences, rocketry, robotics, environmental protection, and computer science. There are nearly 33,000 4-H members in North Dakota, supported and encouraged by about 3,000 adult volunteers. The first full week in October is designated as National 4-H Week. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's coming up on 3:55 Central, 2:55 Mountain. My name is Craig Blumenschein. I'm the host and producer of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Pleased to be joined by Christine McClellan. She's the communications manager here at Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us here, we and this station, we depend on listener support. Prairie Public depends on you. In fact, you power Prairie Public, and we're asking you to take a moment to become a sustaining member at prairiepublic.org or by calling us at 800-359-4145. The process takes just a few minutes, but it is so important. Any amount that you can donate, as Paula Kirker told us earlier, is important to Prairie Public, and it sure is. I get to work with Main Street every day, and we get to tell stories that shape our communities. I get to travel to Bismarck, to Jamestown, all over the state, to Minot, to Wahpeton, and bring stories that matter, and we do our best to tell stories with accuracy, care, and connection, and that's all thanks to you.
800-359-4145 is the number you can call to donate, or prairiepublic.org. We've heard from people in some of those communities you just mentioned, Dana from Dickinson, Joel and Nancy from Fargo. We've heard from, I know, Minot, Devil's Lake, Grand Forks, all over the state and the region are supporting us during this fall membership drive. It's the final day of the drive today. We just have a few hours left, and we have about $11,000 to reach our goal. And it was a lofty goal that we set for this drive. It was actually a record, and so we've already been doing awesome, but we would love for your help to help us reach that goal. So it's 800-359-4145, or you can go online to prairiepublic.org.
And what, Christine, we hope that folks don't delay. We hope that they take action right now, because that gives us the ability to plan in these uncertain times. Steady, reliable funding, a sustaining membership. It's so important to us because it's something that Prairie Public counts on when everything else feels uncertain. $10 a month, it may not seem like a lot, but together, those gifts create something strong, something that's local for us here in North Dakota and Western Minnesota, something that's lasting. PrairiePublic.org, 800-359-4145. Become a sustaining member today, and your monthly support will keep trusted local stories like I get to bring, storytelling that we bring here every day and that Christine brings in her communications work to our listeners.
800-359-4145 is the number you can call. And like you said, sustaining support, it's what we can count on now. Our federal funding is gone. As of October 1st, we no longer can count on funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our funding was reduced at the state level, so our members are who can propel us into the future and make up for some of that lost funds. So prairiepublic.org, or give us a call, 800-359-4145.
And that about wraps up what we have for you for Main Street. In just a moment, you'll hear the stories that are coming your way tomorrow. But before you go, right now, if you can, 800-359-4145, or bounce online, prairiepublic.org. And that wraps up today's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us today. And before we go, a reminder, there is still time to make your fall membership drive gift. Prairie Public depends on you to keep trusted news, children's programs, and local stories on the air. Every donation at any level makes a real difference. Give now at prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145. And coming tomorrow on Main Street, as Dickinson State University celebrates 100 years of Blue Hawks football, co-author Dr. Deborah Dragseth joins us to reflect on a century of touchdowns, traditions, and community pride, and why collegiate athletics still matter. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Thanks for listening. We look forward to seeing you again.